Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Capital One has a fresh take on banking. Now you can open a new savings account in about 5 minutes and earn five times the national average. Banking with Capital One means five times the savings toward your dream honeymoon, or five times the savings toward your family's ultimate vacation, even five times the savings toward just feeling good about saving. It's time to make your savings goals come true. This is Banking Reimagined. What's in your wallet? Capital One, N.A. member, FDIC.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and at 14 hours GMT on Tuesday, the 24th of March, these are our main stories. The Tokyo Olympics are to be delayed by a year because of the coronavirus outbreak. In Spain, the past 24 hours have seen another grim record of just over 500 victims of the virus. But restrictions in Hubei province in China are soon to be lifted. Also in this podcast, the illustrator Albert Uderzo, one of the creators of the Asterix and Obelix comics, has died at the age of 92, and we'll have tips on how to cope with self-isolation. After weeks of speculation, Japan has finally bowed to the inevitable and agreed to postpone the Tokyo Olympics because of the coronavirus pandemic. The Japanese Prime Minister asked for a year's delay, and the head of the Olympic Committee agreed. The Games will still be called Tokyo 2020, according to the city's governor. Oliver Conway spoke to our sports news correspondent, Alex Capstick.
The IOC will hold an executive board meeting very soon, and then it will be formally announced that the Games will be postponed. Shinzo Abe spoke to Thomas Bach, the IOC president, earlier today about whether they should postpone the Games. With the torch relay starting on Thursday, it made sense to make a decision sooner rather than later. You might remember on Sunday, the IOC released a statement in which they said that they would look at postponement, but they wouldn't make a decision for a maximum of four weeks. And people around the world, athletes, National Olympic Committees, other organisations involved with the Olympics, were aghast at that. They said it had to be made, the decision had to be made much sooner. Well, clearly that has hit home. They've had this conversation and they've agreed that the Games will be postponed until 2021 at the latest.
Yeah, so a year's delay looking likely. Will that be enough?
Well, who knows? That's guesswork, Ollie. Nobody really knows how long the virus will be around for. Obviously, it's hoped that it will be contained by then and athletes will be able to get out and start training and start competing. I mean, that was the real problem here. It was athletes were saying, look, we can't go out. And certainly athletes in Europe or the United States, we can't go out, we can't train, we can't compete. We need some clarity on this. And they were appealing to the IOC for that. They've got that now. You know, if the virus continues to spread and it's not contained, obviously they'll have to think again. But clearly they had to make some sort of decision this week before the torch relay started in Japan.
That was Alex Capstick. The latest figures from Spain show that just under 2,700 people have now died from COVID-19. That's up more than 500 over the previous day and means the numbers of Spanish deaths could soon exceed China's. Guy Hedgeco is in Madrid.
The government has said that this is going to be an absolutely key week. However, it has also said that it's hoping that the numbers are going to flatten out in the coming days as well. We've heard stories of retirement homes being found by members of the armed forces who've been involved in the battle against coronavirus, discovering the abandoned dead bodies of elderly people in care homes. Care homes have been a particular problem here in Spain. The virus has spread through a number of them, both here in Madrid and in other parts of Spain, and that has obviously affected a group which is very vulnerable, which is the elderly. At the weekend, a huge conference centre in Madrid was transformed into a makeshift hospital with several thousand beds in it. That's now the largest hospital in Spain. Before that, hotels were being converted into makeshift hospitals as well. An ice rink here in the capital has been turned into a makeshift morgue as well. So those are now some common measures that are being taken to try and improvise and to try and handle the massive overflow from a health system which is under tremendous pressure, particularly in Madrid.
That was Guy Hedgeco.
Testing has also officially shown that 14% of the health staff are positive. This doctor, Dunia Hernandez, has been treating patients at a hospital outside Barcelona. 5 days ago, she herself tested positive for the virus and was put under quarantine.
At the beginning of this whole crisis, every staff that had been in contact with a positive COVID case was sent home for 14 days. But today it is like assumed that we have this contact every day and only the staff who show symptoms are tested. And only those positive with symptoms go home for 10 days. This means that you can be in the incubation period and still be working. So the scary thing of it all is that one in four infected by COVID-19 is a health worker. And if we start getting infected, we will not be able to attend the demanding patients. And this means not only patients positive for COVID-19, but those with others, many other severe conditions.
The BBC's James Menendez spoke to Daniel Lopez Acuña, a former WHO official who's now professor at the Andalusian School of Public Health, about why the virus is spreading so much in Spain.
Probably the issue is there is more interaction between the provinces in Spain. The central area, the capital, was very hot in terms of transmission, and then still before the measures of containment and lockdown, the people were traveling, so you could have a more widespread transmission to begin with, plus the fact that some of the imported cases that came from Italy in the very beginning were coming not only to Madrid or to Barcelona, but to different regions.
We've also been hearing some terrible stories about troops, soldiers who've been drafted in, going into nursing homes, care homes, and finding people who died in their beds alone.
This is of great concern in the country, and both the military and the police and the health authorities have addressed this in their daily briefing today. I think we have a reality which applies to all countries. You have a confined population that is the high risk and where the severity is greater. It is extremely important to seal them, not to permit visits, not to permit exits, to be very rigorous with the socio-sanitary workers that work there, and then take the proper action when there is an outbreak there, either of referral to hospitals and or isolation. Some of the residences that were not medicalized in Spain are showing that there may be outbreaks that were not adequately controlled initially. Take it as one of the Achilles heel of the transmission and of the expansion and amplification of the epidemic.
Daniel Lopez Acuña, and he was talking to James Menendez. Well, as we record this podcast, the number of cases globally is reaching 400,000, and many people around the world are being asked to stay at home. But in Wuhan, 3 months after China confirmed that they were treating dozens of cases of an unknown kind of pneumonia, authorities have announced restrictions will lift on the 8th of April, and in the rest of Hubei province at midnight tonight. However, China says it's still concerned about a second wave of infections being brought in from abroad. This was the message in the latest government briefing.
Statistics has shown that there has been an increase of imported cases in cities as ports of entries and transportation hubs. They are faced with greater pressure of prevention of imported cases. There has been great outcome in domestic control, and there has been an increasing pressure of imported risks. Will there be a second wave of transmission because of imported cases? This is a question of public concern.
So what has life been like in Wuhan, and how quickly will it return to normal? Oliver Conway spoke to our China correspondent, Robin Brandt.
Well, it's an obscure place, but it is a city of a population of 11 million people, so it is huge. It has been cut off from the rest of China and the rest of the world since January the 23rd. No one in, no one out, no one moving around residential compounds, no transport, no shops. This is a place that shut down and shut down very, very quickly. But now there does appear to be light at the end of the tunnel. And as you say, come April the 8th, anyone living in the city who wants to leave and is able to generate a green code on a health app, on a smartphone. These are being widely used here. They're kind of traffic light systems. Anyone who has that in Wuhan will be able to leave. Restrictions being lifted sooner in the surrounding province of Hubei, and much of this is being mirrored across mainland China. But nonetheless, it's a, you know, in Shanghai here, I'm 1,000 kilometres from Wuhan. It's a return to business, but I wouldn't say it's a return to normal. Temperature checks everywhere. That health app kind of becomes your passport to getting, you know, everywhere into shops, into hotels if you need to do that kind of thing. So it's business, but it's not a return to normal.
And how confident are they that they have got it under control in Wuhan itself? Because it recorded a new case after 5 days without any.
Well, look, I think this is a really important point. You know, we heard that clip from the briefing this morning. Much of the emphasis is on the threat from abroad. The reality is there is a fear of a second wave, but most of the people coming here bringing it are Chinese nationals coming home. But let's not forget as well about the fear domestically about what happens when the door essentially is unlocked in Wuhan again. Is that fear that was always there from the beginning of a second wave generated by people leaving the city. One new case confirmed today, one new case of a domestic transmission, but we're seeing reports as well this week about asymptomatic cases. Officials there confirming that many cases where people haven't been hospitalised or haven't shown any symptoms haven't been counted in the official numbers. So there would appear to be people there that are positive, do have COVID-19, but are not being counted in the numbers. And concern persists about the accuracy, the veracity of Chinese domestic numbers and the extent to which there's a propaganda message being pushed from Xi Jinping down. A big, big, significant push on getting the economy back to normal. You know, victory over the virus. But the extent to which that is contrary to some of the evidence we're seeing on the ground, particularly in Wuhan, when it comes to counting the cases. And indeed dealing with those cases.
And the rest of the world will, of course, be watching and hoping things go well in Wuhan. Is there any thought about stopping this kind of thing emerging again, closing perhaps those wet markets?
Well, there is. I mean, some of those promises were made after the SARS outbreak almost 18 years ago. And there were already pledges very quickly in the early weeks about reforming those massive open wet markets where, you know, raw meat is traded, animals are exchanged, fresh food people go to in their thousands of numbers across thousands of cities across this country. But I think, frankly, at the moment, that's for another day in terms of delivering on that. But, you know, there are many cultures in this country, in the thousands of cities in this country where those things have gone on for a very long time for various reasons, and this is not a habit of eating, of trading that's going to suddenly change overnight, even though we've had something that's been as disastrous as this has and continues to be for China and the rest of the world.
That was Robin Brandt in Shanghai. Well, among those people hoping to benefit soon from the slackening of restrictions in Wuhan is a British man, Connor Reid. He was one of the first to contract COVID-19 all the way back in November. After eventually recovering, he found himself in quarantine along with everyone else in Wuhan. He spoke to James Menendez.
It's certainly exciting. We've all been in the same boat for more than 50 days now, so I expect there'll be people dancing in the streets and celebrating.
How's it been being in quarantine for so long? How have you kept going?
It's a case of filling my time with things to do. Obviously, physical health is important, but mental health is just as equally as important. And it's beneficial to keep mentally stimulated every day, whether reading books or painting or doing whatever. As long as you have varied things to do, it really does help.
And how's your physical health? Because you were really quite sick, weren't you, with the virus?
Yes, I was. Currently, my physical health is fine. There's really no problems at all. In regards to before, I was quite sick, but I have heard that once you have the coronavirus once, you have antibodies to protect yourself. So it's very difficult to get it again.
And does that give you some comfort in the weeks and months to come?
Well, yes. I also want to capitalize on it and see if I can help other people. Obviously, support workers are quite scared at the moment because they don't want to be exposed to it. I can certainly help with things like that because I don't have a fear of getting it again.
Is there worry in the city about what might happen when the restrictions are lifted, that it might come back again?
Yes, there is. And I imagine that although the quarantine measures will be lifted, people will be still cautious and people will have things like masks still, and they'll be practicing social distancing, I think, for a further 6 months.
You're a young man and you got it, and you got it pretty badly. I mean, for those people who think we're overreacting, again, what would you say?
It only takes one person that's infected to enter a household, and then four people are infected, then 8, 16, 32, and by that time, your whole town is infected with people. It really affects the old people the most, and they're the people that we need to be protecting the most.
That was Conor Reid, hoping to leave Wuhan soon to return to the UK to see his parents. Now, humans are generally social creatures, and it can be a struggle adapting to new, less social ways of living. Beth Healy is a doctor interested in extreme environment, physiology, isolation and space. She spoke to us from Switzerland about what she's learned.
I was working as a research doctor for the European Space Agency in Antarctica on their Concordia platform. And there I was researching the effects of the isolation on the crew during Antarctic overwinter. And I'm also an emergency medicine doctor, and I've worked as part of medical and logistical support teams in a number of sort of extreme and remote environments as well, on expeditions in Greenland, Svalbard, Siberia and North Pole previously as well.
So clearly we have come to the right person. Give us an idea about what's sort of impact isolation can have on the human mind.
It can be really challenging for a lot of people. It can cause people to lose a lot of motivation. It can make people depressed. And also you can have a lot of monotony, boredom, and also you can find it very difficult often. And because often you're not actually isolated on your own, although that will be the case for some people, but often isolated in small groups, and that can also bring challenges as well, sort of live in work effectively together and part of those teams.
Absolutely, because even people that you love, family members who are very important to you, if you are with them 24 hours a day for weeks on end, it could be hard.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's really important to sort of learn about the team that you're going to be isolating with. So if that's your family, about how different members of that group might react to different situations, and also how you can live in your sort of habitat effectively together as well. So making sure that you give each other enough space. Something that we did in Antarctica was your bedroom was always your private space, and even sort of close friends weren't able to go into that area, so that you always had somewhere to go. So for example, in the current crisis, something that you might consider would be to make like a small den for children, and also to sort of really work out how you're going to use that space during that time to make sure that everyone can get away from each other when they want to as well.
That's a really good tip. I like the idea of a den. In fact, I might get one of those myself. What are the key tips to stay mentally healthy when you are in isolation?
I think it's really important to break everything down. So not to look at the whole isolation period, but to try and look at sort of each day and each week as it comes, and to set yourself little goals and little challenges which you can achieve as well during that period. Because I think it's really important for your motivation to carry on with things if you can feel that you're achieving. So I think a lot of people, you know, at the beginning of the isolation period, it can be sort of a novelty. It's a bit like sort of making New Year's resolutions. There's all these things that you want to do, but the challenging part can then be to really continue with it during the period of isolation and to remain motivated. And by sort of goal setting and sort of having things that you can tick off that you've done, really is useful to keep people motivated.
It's difficult as well, isn't it? Because at this point, it's still ongoing. We aren't exactly sure how long we are going to have to be resilient for.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that is a very sort of unique situation that we have here with that. And I think because of that, you know, because you don't have a finish point, I think it is useful to sort of just, you know, take each week as it comes, and potentially rather than trying to sort of look towards the finish, but also to keep in mind that a finish will come, and to think of things that you'd like to do when isolation is over, and also to plan for that. You know, lots of people in Antarctica used to plan for sort of a big trip or holiday that they would have when they got back, and I think that was a really useful thing to sort of look beyond and really plan for what you're going to do afterwards.
Dr. Beth Healy, and we will hear the top tip from Global News podcast listener Alessio in Italy a little later about coping with being stuck at home. Still to come in this podcast.
I've had just enough of getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning fighting to get gear. I'm gonna have to close down. I'll go off work for 2 weeks.
She's an essential worker, but this fruit and veg stallholder in London is closing down. In the US, as of Tuesday morning, there are more than 46,000 confirmed cases and almost 600 deaths because of COVID-19. But President Trump has hinted that he wants to reopen the economy, saying he'll make a decision on how to tackle the disease in 15 days' time. He's tweeted, "We cannot let the cure be worse than the problem." As our North America editor John Sopel reports, there's growing tension in the White House between the medical experts and political advisers who think the path to re-election is through a booming stock market and low unemployment.
A tale of two tweets, each the president posted on Sunday night, and each in their own way emblematic of Donald Trump and his response to this crisis. Let's deal with the most significant first. It said, "We cannot let the cure be worse than the problem itself. At the end of the 15-day period, we'll make a decision as to which way we want to go." A point he expanded on at his daily briefing last night.
At some point, we're going to open up our country, and it's going to be fairly soon.
Weeks or months?
I'm not looking at months, I can tell you right now.
In other words, lift restrictions as soon as possible. Donald Trump's messaging has on occasions been erratic, and sometimes what the president has said has been starkly at odds with what his experts have recommended. But this emerging policy of lifting the shutters on the US economy is a sign that the president wants to break with his public health professionals and go with his gut. Why? Well, because the president's whole re-election strategy for November was built on going to the country with a stock market soaring and unemployment at a record low.
Our economy is the envy of the world. Perhaps the greatest economy we've had in the history of our country. And as long as you keep this team in place, our future has never, ever looked brighter or sharper.
Except COVID-19 is likely to result in the exact opposite. Record highs for joblessness, the stock market in a slump, and the US economy in the toilet. A far cry from the Keep America Great playbook. And there are many business leaders who similarly feel that the remedy is worse than the disease, that an economy is being sacrificed for a small percentage of very vulnerable people. And many of those voices have the president's ear. If he does change course, which he seems determined to do, and say to people infected with coronavirus, it's okay for you to return to work, providing you wear a mask, it would be a life and death gamble. Potentially many lives and many deaths. If he doesn't, then he's going to have to go to the country as the leader who took America through its darkest hour, as Churchill described that period after the fall of France, and that he, Donald J. Trump, is best placed to lead them into the light. This isn't what he planned. And that brings us to the second tweet from Sunday night. He railed at the media, even his beloved Fox News. "All I see is hatred of me at any cost," he said. This president craves praise, and at the moment it's decidedly thin on the ground, even from normally reliable ciphers.
That was John Sopel in the US. Here in the UK, there is still some confusion about what is allowed and not allowed in the partial lockdown in Britain, which came into effect overnight, as images of some crowded tubes in London continue to fill social media. Unless people are classified as essential workers, they can only go out to buy food, for medical help, or for one period of exercise a day. But a senior cabinet minister, Michael Gove, said construction workers could continue.
Construction should continue on sites. People should obviously exercise sensitivity and common sense and follow social distancing measures. But construction in the open air on those sorts of sites can continue. It's important that we make sure that construction and manufacturing can continue. And that seems to me to be the safest way of ensuring that we can maintain appropriate social distancing rules in a way which ensures that people who cannot work from home can continue to do so.
On the essential list are, of course, pharmacies and food shops. But Tracy, the owner of a fruit and veg stall in Brixton Market in London, says despite this, she will close because of price rises and abuse from customers.
I've been here 35 years and I've never, ever worked under these conditions in my life. I wanted to stay open, but the abuse and that we're getting at the moment is, you know, over 50p or even a 5p carrier bag. It's absolutely disgusting. And when I questioned, obviously, the wholesalers over the market, they were saying because the gear was coming from Spain and Italy and obviously out of our country, and when they would come here, normally they would pick other stuff up to take back. Because they'd found the lorries are going back empty, that's where the prices were going up, why it was going up. You know, nothing's getting picked. You know, we've already gone on a shortage now with carrots, spring onions, potatoes. Every single item that I work has jumped up by at least £5 to £10. How am I meant to make any money? I have wages to pay, stock. I'm paying 40 pence for a lemon, and you want me to give you four for a pound. How does that even work? You know, you try to explain to people, but they're not having none of it. They just think that we are basically bumping up the prices for the sake of it. So due to that reason, I've had just enough of getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning fighting to get gear.
Sorry, so what are you going to do now?
I'm going to have to close down. I'm not going to stand here and risk my life if someone cannot be civilised to me. I'll go off work for 2 weeks. At least I know my health. I'll be safer than having to take this.
And this is a food shop, so you imagine it's quite an essential... It's a fruit stall, so you'd imagine it's an essential service.
Yeah, well, when the supermarkets run out, they'll come to us. But now I'm not going to be here. So it just makes life harder. If everyone was just to calm down, stop all this panic buying and stop being greedy, you know, we'd get back to normal and all the prices will go back to normal. Until then, it's just going to be, I don't know, it's a horrible, horrible atmosphere to work in. Really, really, it's not nice at all. I've never, ever worked like this before in my life, and I don't see, I can't go on working like this because I'm actually drained from it all.
That was Tracy, a fruit and veg stall holder in Brixton Market in London. Myanmar in East Asia has reported its first confirmed cases of coronavirus infections. Officials say those infected were two local men who had recently arrived from abroad. In the country's largest city, Yangon, health workers have been spraying disinfectant at local markets and urging people to wash their hands. Kyo Win is a shop owner in Yangon.
There aren't enough medical supplies in the hospitals. Even developed countries can't cope with this virus, so how can we do it? I'm worried.
Our Southeast Asia correspondent is Jonathan Head.
With a population of 54 million, a long border with China, and one of the world's most poorly resourced public health systems, Myanmar's vulnerability to the new coronavirus has long worried health experts. There's been widespread scepticism over the official statistic showing no infections, even as neighbouring countries have seen numbers rising sharply over the past week. Only around 300 people have so far been tested for the virus, compared to tens of thousands in Thailand and Malaysia. Now Myanmar has its first reported coronavirus cases, both travellers from overseas. It may have to follow its neighbours in shutting down most public life, including bars and restaurants. This has already happened in the Thai capital, Bangkok, and is gradually being extended to the rest of the country. Doctors at one of Bangkok's top hospitals have issued a stark warning to the people of Thailand that if stricter social distancing measures are not immediately implemented, they will see more than 300,000 coronavirus cases within 30 days and more than 7,000 deaths, overwhelming the country's hospitals.
That was Jonathan Head. Now, on to a different story. You do not need to know French to recognise these characters.
Je vous présente Johnny Thorax.
Enchanté, secouons-nous la main.
A trailer from the film Asterix and Obelix, based on the comic series of the same title, and we're playing this clip in remembrance of their co-creator, Albert Uderzeau, who has died aged 92. So just how important are his creations in French culture? Here's our arts correspondent, Vincent Dowd.
It was a huge part of French culture. Asterix began 60 years ago as a bande dessinée, in other words, a comic book, in what was then a new magazine called Pilote for France and Belgium. The magazine was a bit like, say, Mad in the USA. In other words, it was for intelligent teenagers and grown-ups, a comic strip about a bunch of Gauls who fought the Romans in the era of Julius Caesar. The words originally were by René Goscinny, who actually died in 1977. He was only in his early 50s when he died. And the artwork was by Uderzo, who was born in 1927. After Goscinny's death at the age of 51, Albert Uderzo took on the words very, very unwillingly at first about a decade ago. He, in effect, retired and he sold the rights to Hachette, the big publisher, and Asterix has continued with a new team doing it. There was some controversy because Asterix had become part of the patrimony, really, of France, and some people thought it shouldn't be passed on to other people. It's a mock heroic adventure. A few of the titles give you an idea. Asterix the Gaul, Asterix in Britain, Asterix and the Goths. They play on the fact that maybe none of us really know much about that world. We just have a very vague idea outside of France anyway. And Goscinny and Oderzo use that brilliantly to set up a world of jokes and crazy characters and imagination, but always with a hint of satire. Most major French politicians along the way sort of appeared as minor characters. The stories came out in comic books, but each would become a hardback book too, and they sold massively in French, but also to some degree in the English-speaking world as well.
Yeah, I remember them stereotyping the UK as a place where everyone stopped for tea at 4 o'clock. But not only comic books, also films.
No, films going back to 1967, translated into English. Maybe they lose some of their charm when they're not in French. But we heard a bit there from Asterix, God Save Britannia. So some of the films starring often Gérard Depardieu did do well at the box office outside France.
Vincent Dowd talking to Oliver Conway about Albert Uderzo, who has died aged 92. Now, there are a lot of Global News podcast listeners around the world who are having to stay at home just now, and not everyone will be finding it easy, so we asked for your top tips on keeping your spirits up. Here's one from Italy.
Hi, I am Alessio, 27 years old, from Milan, Italy. Now I've been quarantined for 2 weeks. My main advice is to stay healthy. And you stay mentally healthy by organizing your day. Every night I write down a to-do list. And you must be reasonable with your goals. Nobody's expected to learn a language in 1 month. I choose between house cleaning chores or fixing things, something you wouldn't have time to do on the regular routine. Other examples could be organizing files or pictures. You must be reasonable. The other tip is to maintain a regular sleep routine. You wake up early in the morning and you go to bed early. And don't indulge in afternoon naps.
He had me right up to no naps. Thanks, Alessio. Do keep them coming. How you keep your spirits up when in isolation, you might just make a difference. And that's it from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. And a reminder that we're going to be doing a special coronavirus edition at the beginning of next week. You might remember that the first one was at the beginning of this month, really just a few weeks ago, but things have changed since then. So if you have questions, do send them to us, preferably, but not necessarily, a recording of you asking what it is you want to know, and we will try and find an answer for you. The address, as ever, is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye.